This is the Read, Write, and Create podcast, the podcast where you get a bite-sized session of creative writing coaching from me, Lori L. Tharps. I'm an award-winning author of both fiction and nonfiction, a journalist, and a former college professor. I've spent more than 20 years writing, teaching, and coaching creative writers, so I created this podcast because I want to help as many BIPOC writers as possible get their stories out of their heads and into the world. Are you ready? Let's go. On episode 25 of the podcast, I am so excited to welcome New York Times bestselling author Ilyan Wu to the show. Ilyan Wu is the author of Master Slave, Husband, Wife, an epic journey from slavery to freedom. She's also the author of The Great Divorce, a 19th century mother's extraordinary fight against her husband, the Shakers, and her times. Ilyan's writing has appeared in the Boston Globe, the Wall Street Journal, Time, and the New York Times, and she has received support for her research from the Whiting Foundation, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the American Antiquarian Society, among other institutions. She holds a BA in the Humanities from Yale College and a PhD in English from Columbia University. People, you are in for a real treat with this episode because Ilyan is amazing. And we had so much fun talking about her work as a writer, historian, and accidental activist who writes about these hidden figures in history in a way that her stories jump off the page and read like dramatic thrillers rather than anything you might have read in a high school history book. During our conversation, Ilyan tells me how she finds her subjects. We talk about her writing process for these weighty nonfiction books and what jelly beans have to do with her writing process. We also talk about what impact her Asian American heritage has had on her career and on the subjects that she chooses to write about. And finally, Ilyan also talks about how she fell in love with her subjects of her most recent book, Master Slave, Husband, Wife, talking about the couple at the center of the story, Ellen and William Craft. She talks about how she's actually maintained a relationship with the Craft's descendants and is still working with them long after the book's been out to help them bring the story of their famous relatives to public attention. Please sit back, get comfy, make yourself a cup of tea, and enjoy this inspiring and informative episode. Welcome to the Read, Write, and Create podcast, Ilyan Wu. It's so good to have you here.
It's wonderful to be here with you today.
So we're going to just jump right into it because I have so many questions for you. I am truly bowing down to your output as a writer and a historian. So we're going to really dive into how you create these incredible stories. But before we get into the actual writing, I'm just curious if you can share with us a little bit, like, how did you start your career and what was your inspiration as a writer? I was wondering if you were like interested in history. Were you interested in writing? Was it both? Tell us a little bit about what inspired you as a storyteller and a writer.
Well, I love the word storytelling because that's absolutely where I started. I mean, I guess the stories that I started with were ones that were told to me. I had stories both read and told to me since it's one of my earliest memories. So I've always had a connection to stories, whether it's like Korean folk tales that my dad would tell me before bed or some of the European ones that he'd plagiarize. And I didn't realize that they were actually not Korean folk tales until much, much later. And I have a lot of storytellers in the family, a lot of history that they tell, and it's not written down. And even if it was written down, it would have been written down in Korean, which I am not fluent at reading, although I can understand. So I guess I just was open to a lot of different ways of receiving stories. In terms of the writing of them, you know, again, I started there with being an absorber of stories, a reader, first and foremost. I loved reading from ever since I was teeny tiny. And I think there's a pretty natural step that comes from reading stories and loving them so much and sort of wanting to try it yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. So before we talk about Master Slave, Husband, Wife, I did want to jump to your first book, which was The Great Divorce, a 19th century mother's extraordinary fight against her husband, the Shakers, and Her Times. What a subtitle. But the subtitle pretty much tells you what this book is about. It's about this woman whose husband takes their three children and takes them to go live with the Shaker community in the 1800s, and she fights to get her kids back. I mean, it literally sounds like a modern day soap opera or telenovela or something. Yeah. And I'm just curious, that was your first book, is that correct?
It was, yeah.
Yeah, so where did that come from? Like, and what inspired you to say, you know what, I'm going to spend a lot of time excavating this story and telling the world? What was your, like, where did that come from?
That's a, such a funny question. You know, I would have to say again there too. I mean, here's the power of childhood, right? I was dragged to many Shaker villages and other historic sites when I was a child. So my parents are a little quirky. They're not like the typical, I don't know, when most people think of like with Asian parents. They're both artists. They're really into design. And whenever we had guests from either elsewhere in the country or Korea, we go to these Shaker villages because the design was so gorgeous. But again, there, the storytelling was really powerful. The first years that I went, there was an actual Shaker. So this is a celibate, essentially utopian society in America's longest lasting communal society. They still have a few members right now in Maine, but they're known, of course, for this gorgeous furniture and boxes, and Oprah is a big collector. I mean, there are a lot of celebrity fans now of their incredibly beautiful modern handiwork. So my parents were like ogling the boxes and the chairs and all those things. And as a kid, I was really tuning into the stories, and especially the question of what it would be like to be separated from my loved ones, because that's one of the requirements of the society, celibacy, communal living, and really putting the community first. And so if you enter as a child, you're separated from your parents, you're living in this children's order. It just seemed fascinating and kind of terrible, terrifying for me as a kid. And I guess I just sort of entered there imaginatively. So that was a starting point. And I just had this really weird obsession with the Shakers. I still can't quite explain it, but when I go to these villages and they're beautiful, just, it's a transporting experience for me. And when I was in graduate school, I wanted to study about them. And pretty much everybody thought I was completely bonkers, except for maybe Eric Foner. He was encouraging. I did a first research paper on them. But that was, again, taking a history class and not a literature class. And I actually had one advisor say, if you do the Shaker thing, I can't work with you. Yeah.
I'm sorry. That's hilarious.
Yeah. And so what happened actually was, and I've been trying to leave academia. I mean, talk about trying to leave a cult, which is, some people compare the Shakers to like a cult-like place. Like really after my first year, I was just like, I want to get out of here. But I had an incredible mentor, and he was also a law professor, so was able to sort of talk me into staying every time I wanted to leave. And I'm really glad I did it. But this is a very long story. But I ended up leaving, finally. And I worked in information design. And then the whole information design web space was kind of blowing up. And I decided, I started thinking about wanting to come back. But if I was going to come back, I wanted to write about something I really wanted to write about and not just cobble together something based on the previous papers I had written. And then 9/11 happened. And especially then, I was like, I don't want to waste my time spending so much time with things that don't matter so much to me. And I could have churned out a more marketable dissertation, but I was like, heck, I'm going to write about the Shakers. And by this time, like, my mentor was like, all right, you're coming back, you can do the Shaker thing. And there it went.
So this was actually your dissertation, your thesis?
I wrote a very obscure thesis about people who joined and left the Shakers. So there are these people who would go to these Shaker societies, sometimes for a short period of time, sometimes for as long as 15 years. And then they would write these kind of tell-alls. So going back to the telenovela idea, right, about their experiences there. But the ones that I sought out were, it was called Rational Renegades. I was seeking out people who joined and really were torn and interested and immersed and left. The one exception being Eunice Chapman, the heroine of my first book. And it's the thing that I found most interesting about it is that you could do like a, I don't know, a Lifetime movie or something based on it and have this like courageous woman and she's taking on these horrible, evil people. But, you know, my first point of connection with the story was with the Shakers, who I grew to love. And actually, if you look at their respective writings about it, one can actually be more sympathetic sometimes to the Shaker side. I mean, I won't go off too long about this book, but it is really a situation where I could see things from both sides. And that's something that really interests me, is not just saying, all right, here's a good guy, here's a bad guy, root for this one, and let's knock this guy down. But it's really to see, how could we have ended up in such a messy situation? And how can we see it from different perspectives? And I think that's a question that extends across both books.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's where you're a storyteller, right? I haven't read the book, but I've read about it. And I know that even the woman, Eunice, has her own habits that some people wouldn't necessarily find attractive.
Oh, yeah. To put it mildly.
So you are a storyteller because you want to show the entirety of these people. Like, they're, like you said, not a good guy, not a bad guy. And that's what makes a really good story. I think what also makes a good story is the drama in both of your books, Master Slave, Husband, Wife. It's interesting. I noticed that both of your stories kind of deal with a marriage, you know, kind of have a couple at the center, one that's fighting and one that's deeply in love. So let's jump to Master Slave, Husband, Wife. I know it's coming, or it just came out in paperback. It's February 2024 when we're recording. So in a nutshell, you could say that this is the story of a couple who were enslaved in Georgia, and they escaped slavery by disguising themselves. The wife had a white father, so she disguised herself as the master, and her African-American husband poses as her slave. And they, you know, this is their harrowing story, dramatic story of escape. And then, of course, you know, what happens after and after and after and after, because it's America. And even if you do, quote unquote, escape, there's still so much danger at every turn. So I wonder if you can tell us a little bit first, just how you came to discover this story. I'm assuming your parents didn't take you to slave plantations growing up.
No, but my children have actually seen plenty now of such historic sites. Yeah. So maybe, I don't know what will happen to them one day. But
well, hey, yeah, maybe they're going to end up being storytellers of a different sort. Who knows? It'll be a good one. But yeah, tell us a little bit about the origins for you of coming into possession of this story. And what I'm even more interested in is deciding, I'm going to tell this story.
Well, it's interesting that you use the word possession, because I think actually the last thing I would ever claim to do is possess the story, but I felt possessed by the story from the moment that I read it, that I first read it. And actually, I first encountered the crafts roughly around the time I first encountered Eunice Chapman. So this was all through reading. You know, I was in the literature department. I did take history courses when I'm trained in literature. And, you know, whether it's the Shaker tell-all or the crafts narrative is not a tell-all, but it is a work that was produced with a very specific activist agenda. Both works were. And so they use the power of narrative to try to move people into action. These aren't just static stories. And that's part of the reason why I think they're both so propulsive, because they are not only describing action, but they're a call to action. And I felt that really strongly when I read the crafts narrative. It just was. You know, I mean, I know that you're also like an avid reader, but sometimes you just get pulled into the story from like the first couple lines and you don't know what it is, but there's something that's inviting you to enter into that world. And I felt that. I mean, the voice was unlike anything I had ever heard before. And I still hear it. And I still love to go back and read it and listen to it. And the tremendous irony, as well as the heartbreak, there's a very direct feeling about this voice where it feels like it's speaking to you. And again, I think that may come from that call to action theme. So that's where I first encountered them, by reading their own words in their 1860 narrative, Running 1,000 Miles to Freedom. But it took me, decades more, like 20 years more at least, to really start thinking about writing the story.
I love that you use that term, activist agenda. And that's actually one of my questions I want to get to a little bit later. But I think it's so fascinating. And again, it does speak to this idea of literature as activism, because they wrote their own story. They knew that this should be documented. And what's amazing is that they were not literate when they started this journey, which makes it even more powerful to know that that was something that was so important to them, was to get this down on paper, if you will. For everybody listening, if you have not yet read Master Slave, Husband, Wife, you have to read it. I mean, I think of it as, I classify it as another Hidden Figure story, in the sense that this couple has as much influence in the abolitionist movement as Henry Box Brown, Frederick Douglass, William Wells Brown. Yes. So many similar names running through here, yeah. But they had so much influence on this time period, and yet their story kind of disappears to a certain extent. Although I think I heard you speak in another interview where you're like, the people who know, it's not that it's disappeared. It's just that it maybe isn't in the public view as much as maybe it's not in the history books that we're given in general as high school students, or even depending on what you studied and where you studied in college.
Yes, thank you for that.
So I think of it as like a hidden figure story, but it's also literally a gripping page-turning thriller. I mean, you kind of understand before you pick up the book that they made it out of slavery because they wrote about it. You wrote about it.
Yeah.
I mean, even in the subtitle, it's Journey from Slavery to Freedom. So we already know before we crack open the book. And yet I am literally like turning the pages like, oh my God, are they going to make it? Are they going to get caught? And I literally had to tell myself to calm down because you're like, you know the ending. Or you at least know that they're going to make it. And yet you wrote it in such a way that I am literally like in bed, like hyperventilating because I'm like, oh my God. So Ilian, tell us a little bit about how you, as a writer, craft a story that's deep into history, right? I mean, you're working with historical documents, yawn, 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 history is boring, and we all know the ending. Like, you have all these things working against what one would think you could write a quote-unquote page-turner. And I do know that there was an earlier version where maybe you weren't getting it quite so propulsive as you said.
You put everything in the nicest possible way.
But tell us, all of us listening who are, you know, nonfiction writers, journalists, you know, storytellers who are working with historical documents and facts, how did you approach this so that it did feel like, I mean, I was reading it like a novel. I mean, that's what it felt like to me.
It's so great to hear all this feedback. It's like, if you could take me back in time when I'm like banging my head against the table, like, this is never going to work. And I had all the footnotes, but none of the story. And you could tell me that I had a reader who would react in this way. I would have cried even more for joy. You know. So I think it's interesting to be looking back because it was really a struggle to find that narrative voice, especially because I really nerd out in the archives. I mean, when I pick up a history book, I look at the footnotes first. I know. It's like, I actually read footnotes. I look at the index and then I work my way to the beginning. So I love getting deep into the history, and I could have stayed in the archives forever. And there's so many things. I mean, I can tell you more about where I'm sort of trying to put some of the footage that ended up on the cutting room floor, and so many people, because that's another thing that I wanted to do, was not just to look at the crafts, but look at their whole world so that they're not just this footnote or, oh, look at, is this interesting, like sort of blip in history. We should remember them, but this was like a side note and an exception. They absolutely were not. So I wanted to situate them against their world. So I'm trying to deal with this like epic canvas. And at the same time, I am getting lost in my footnotes and how to string a story through. Right? That was really a central challenge. And I think one thing actually that happened, and I'm starting to talk about this in schools, is that sometimes you have what you think, or maybe what other people think, is your greatest weakness. But there's a flip side to that, like a yin and a yang to that quality, whatever it is, where it can also be your greatest strength, either personally or as a writer. And I guess what I'm thinking of now is, now that we had that whole bit about grad school, and when I think about wanting to get out of there, like when I was defending my thesis, my advisors who read the chapter on Eunice Chapman were like, you know, the only problem here is that it feels like you're kind of agnostic. You're not choosing one side or the other. Like, you need to take a stand. And I'm like, I can't do that. Like, I see both sides and I want to see both sides. And that was one of the many signs that made me realize that I didn't want to be an academic writer. I didn't want to have to make those kinds of decisions. But what I think I played to as a strength in this book is, again, the desire to see a whole picture, and not to say this is a bad guy, this is a good guy, but let the readers come to those conclusions based on everything that I've laid out. And how do you do that in a way that moves the story forward? I guess one thing that I did was, this is when I had the really bad draft going on, because I did have a draft. It started off with a really emotionally pivotal moment where William Kraft is a teenager and he's about to be sold on the auction block, but his younger sister has just been sold right before him. And he doesn't recognize the man who was driving her away or about to drive her away in the cart. And he's desperately, he knows that this guy is going somewhere. He could be going anywhere. He could be going like far west for all he knows. So he's desperately trying to connect with his sister one last time. That's the emotional heart, one of the emotional hearts of their narrative. And for me, it's really what pulled me into the story. And so I thought, let's put that front and center. And so I put that front and center. And then I proceeded to, what is the right verb here? I guess descend into a whole rabbit warren of basically what should have been footnotes saying, here's all the background information about the sale that's going on and like the people, the former enslavers and blah, blah, blah. And I went on such a giant tangent that we completely lost sight of the story. And sometimes a moment like that, that pivotal moment, it doesn't have its value until later. And so putting it first isn't necessarily the best way to do it honor or to do it justice. Sometimes, you know, I learned this from painting, like a color pops or has additional meaning depending on the other colors that you're building around it. So once I realized I didn't have to lead with that, or actually that would be a bad idea to lead with that, and that I should lead with the action that begins with their escape, and that I could flash back to those parts, I think that gave me the start of a structure. But the question of then how to move the story from the present into the future with all the backstory too was a huge problem. And I think probably the most useful thing there for me was to actually look outside of, especially history, but even looking outside of writing to other disciplines, other media for inspiration, seeing how they did it. That's what I did, is try to apply techniques of like, say, screenwriting to my own book.
That's interesting that you say that, because it almost unfolded like a movie. I mean, it was very cinematic. You felt the pacing, very forward moving, even if you did jump into flashbacks. I feel like there were cliffhangers. I mean, I feel like it had all these elements of like really masterful storytelling. So I'm wondering though, like, because again, it almost felt like, I mean, there were many, many times when you're writing, like in the voice of Ellen, or you're using her words, you see their dialogues, you see the conversations that the Krafts are having with different, you know, historical figures, et cetera. Did you ever feel like you were writing a novel or inhabiting the voices of these people? Like, did you ever like feel that level of kind of creative freedom, or were you so connected to the documents that you had that it was really like, okay, she said this now, and then she said this? Or was there a point where you did feel like you could kind of craft a scene that was coming from you, that you were kind of just inhabiting these characters as opposed to just following the documents that you had?
Well, you know, that's where there was an interesting tension, because I made a very strong decision at the beginning not to ever use any dialogue or imagination, or I would use the devices, the techniques of fiction. So it has that effect, but everything had to be sourced. So anytime I say she felt scared or he said this, there's a footnote for it. Because I felt like the best way for me to respect them and to respect their story and the text is to get myself the heck out of there and have them lead. And sometimes that's hard, because especially in Ellen's case, she hasn't left behind, oh gosh, if she had left it behind a diary or like letters or something explaining her point of view. Even actually the narrative itself, it's written in William's voice. So she was a collaborator, because he's describing things, or the narrator is describing things that he was not privy to, that she had to have told, but it's all delivered through this ironic, interesting, moving male voice. And that was very conscious on their part.
When you say the narrative, you mean their story that they wrote?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And that was a major source for me. And it's because they told their story in such great detail that I was able to write this book. Because unless you have that firsthand account, what are you going to build on? So it was very much a conscious choice to not fictionalize. And I know some other writers have done that beautifully. For example, Taya Miles in All That She Carried, she had much less to work with. She had just those basically lines of poetry from Ashley Sack. So this is a sack that it was an old cotton seed sack that a mother named Rose filled with and used as an essentially what Miles calls an emergency pack for her daughter. Her daughter, Ashley, was about to be sold. So she includes a tattered dress, 3 handfuls of pecans, a braid of hair. And then the last thing she says as she parts from her daughter and gives her this is, "It be filled with my love always." And it's an incredible object. It's an incredible piece of art and poetry, but Taya Miles had very, very little to go off of. And she has a pretty likely pair of mother and daughter who she thinks were Ashley and Rose, but she's not sure because the sack itself was passed down and then it was found at a flea market or something like that. So what she does is like she has this one moment where she's describing the mother, she's imagining the mother having filled the bag with the pecans and the dress. And then in a last moment, and I just love the word that she chooses, is she takes her braid and she harvests her own hair. So she harvests this. She's feeding her child. She's giving her child a part of her body, an extension of her body that others purport to own. They don't own her. And she's making that clear by giving this to her child. So that's a moment that she enters into imaginatively. And that's a line that I didn't cross. So again, everything was going to have to be documented. But the way I guess I do feel like I kind of got to sit with Ellen and William, and especially Ellen more closely, is that I read so many different sources about her that it was almost like, so I felt like I was doing a lot of eavesdropping and I was getting others' angles into her. And I think there's a quote that's attributed to Aristotle, and I was going to actually ask my classicist friend if this is actually real, but this is a line that goes out a lot in writing classes or screenwriting classes at least, but plot is character revealed by action. And in this case, we know the plot, as you say, like it's a big book and it would have ended very soon if they hadn't made it. So we know what the plot is. We know what the action is. So we have 2 out of the 3 variables. Usually people use this because they don't know what the plot is going to be. And so you take the action and the character and you use those to figure out the plot. But in my case, I know the plot and I know the action. The third variable that is not as clear is character, but it comes through as you discover the other two, as you know the other two, and as you really sort of tune into those.
You know, just from technique, I was never pulled out of the book by this, but I noticed there were times when you would say something like, "We don't know, but maybe Ellen had this thought about having a baby." Like you were clear about saying, "We're not sure if this is what happened or this is what she was thinking, but it's possible given these circumstances or this." And I felt like you did that in a really, again, it was a way that hinted that we can't really know what she was thinking at this time, but based on these circumstances and other evidence, it's very probable that this was the situation or this was the situation. So reading as a writer, you know, noticing those little ways that you were able to acknowledge that you don't know, but not take us out of the story in doing so. I think that was just done really, really well. I'm just curious, how long did it take you to actually write the book? So you said that you heard about the story. I know you heard about the story when you were still in grad school. You said, so once you actually said, okay, I'm doing it, how long was the actual process? And can you give us just a little sense of like, what was that process like? Like 3 years of researching and traveling all over different places. And then it was sitting down in the archives or what? Give us a sense of literally what the timeline was for you to write the book.
Well, I started and stopped. So there were 2 starts. There was 1 start in the early 2010s when the questions were just getting to me and I was rereading the narrative and I started getting secondary sources, which is always my starting point, to read all the literature that's been published about the craft. So I have some books where like there's a receipt there. I'm like, oh, I was looking at this a long time ago, you know, but I felt overwhelmed at that time. I didn't feel like this is something I could do. And I hoped that there might be a book that I could read about the crafts instead of writing one. And then when I really came back to it in earnest was around 2016. And at that point, I started researching and writing at the same time. So I always thought that was crazy. Like when I was a dissertator, people would be like, or my advisor was like, you always have to be writing and you can research as you go along. And it's like, how do you know what to write if you haven't done the research yet? So I'd never done that before. And I'd also never written without like a solid outline. I was a big outliner. And this book just like threw out all my old writing habits and I started completely from scratch.
Wow. So 2016, you're researching, you're writing. How much traveling did you actually do? Because the craft story goes across the US. I mean, we start in the South, we end up in the North, we go to Canada, we go to England. Did you go to all the places where they were, or were you able to use Google Maps?
Well, I did actually use not just Google Maps, but old maps. So if you can't actually do the travel, it's possible to cover the ground in many different ways with these new technologies. And I'd especially recommend the old 19th century maps, because sometimes like an entire landscape will change. There might be like, I don't know, like a cow grazing field or something where you think the part of the city is supposed to be, or like in the case of Boston, like Bay didn't even exist. It was like a really dirty, turgid waters there. And Back Bay was later built. So those things that you can gain from looking at old maps. But I did. I got to travel everywhere. And actually, this is the other thing. I wrote the book out of order, and I also did the research out of order. I don't know how this all happened, but it turned out to be really a boon, because when the pandemic happened, you know, I couldn't get anywhere, but I had actually already done the UK research, which is the last part of the book. And the part where I needed to be on the ground was actually in Boston, and I happened to be living here. So that worked out really well. The one part of the journey that I was not able to go on was to Canada, because that was right in the middle of all of it. So actually the Canada chapter is a little bit shorter.
So everybody listening, I'm going to probably say this 7 more times before I let Ileana go, but you have to read this book. Like, you just have to. You have to read it because it's just a piece of American history that everybody should know. You have to read it because it's just a really good story. But as writers, you have to read it because Ileana did such a great job bringing a story to life that could have been, again, dull history. I think the first thing I ever did, I mean, in terms of connecting with Ileana, was to come on to her DMs or somewhere on Instagram and just be like, this was the most fascinating nonfiction book I've ever read. I've never been this engaged in a nonfiction book. And I like nonfiction. I mean, I do. I read big, fat biographies, but this one did not read that way. And again, if you haven't read the book, go buy it and go read it or take it from the library. But you definitely have to read it as a lesson in craft, no pun intended, with crafts, but really as a lesson in craft and how to make history feel very much alive. And I do realize that this time period, 1860s, is that what it is? Is it 1860s that we're in?
The focus is in the 1848 to 1852, but it does go through the 1860s and beyond.
But it's actually not that long ago, which is the scary part. There were so many moments where I was like, that could be happening right now.
Yeah.
So I want to just get back to that topic that you said earlier, that you felt like to a certain extent, this book and as well as your first book, there's a level of activism there. I mean, you were writing about the first book, The Great Divorce. You have a woman in the early 1800s divorcing her husband and fighting for custody for her children, which again, right in today's time, that's not such a big deal. But back then that was unheard of, or very unusual, I should say. And then you have the crafts who are fighting for their own liberty. Do you feel that you personally, by bringing these particular stories, is your writing a form of activism? Do you see it that way?
I mean, I guess it is, insofar as I hope it will inspire people to action. I mean, I continue to be amazed by the crafts. I mean, I'm still doing, new research will come to me. My publisher would be horrified if they knew that I was still doing the digging, but I still can't stop. But I think what is so powerful about their example, even more so than Eunice Chapman, because Eunice Chapman says to the Shakers, you know, give me my children and I will stop attacking you. And she does. She just does everything to try to bring them down, and she's done because she's achieved her goal. But the craft's goal isn't simply their own freedom. It's so much bigger than that. And one thing I've thought a lot about is because of the craft's great-great-granddaughter, who I actually, well, they have several, but Peggy Trotter Diamond Priestley, who is an oral historian and a poet and just an amazing speaker and legendary lady, freedom writer. She was noting that a lot of people say it's a running 1,000 miles to freedom, when it's the title of their original narrative is Running 1,000 Miles for Freedom. And I think I have been also guilty of accidentally saying to freedom instead of for, but really they are journeying for freedom and they become activists, storytelling activists, as soon as they cross that line. So like within weeks, they are on the road and they're telling their story. It's not just about crossing the Mason-Dixon line. It's not just about having their own freeborn children or acquiring literacy or all those things that are part of their goal, but their goal is to create freedom for themselves and for others. And so to see the decisions they make at every step of the way, where they're putting their lives on the line again and again, is really inspiring. And I hope that it's something that will motivate us in our times to keep challenging our nation for better. And also to remember there were times where things were really horrible in this country. And there were people like the Crafts who were fighting for new levels of freedom that we're lucky to have today, but that we also need to defend and enlarge.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you're saying that about them, that the story, again, would have been a shorter story if they got to freedom and then, you know, hunkered down and just started a family and we didn't hear about them anymore. And there were even times in the story where I was like, you guys, you don't have to do anymore. Like, yeah. Take care of yourselves. You don't have to keep fighting. But they did. And I'm actually working on a speech right now about how storytelling can change the world. And I'm looking for examples of where that has actually happened. Because if you say it, people think that's silly. How can a story change the world? But that really was what the abolitionists were doing, the speakers. They were going all over the world and trying to show people what slavery was by sharing their stories. And it was enough to move people to action. I mean, particularly with the Crafts, you know, it's like, but they seem so... Sorry, this is so stereotypical. They're so articulate. They're so clean. They're so professional. How could they be enslaved? Like, but that's what needed to happen. It was like, these are real people. And it wasn't just Ellen because she was light-skinned. Even William, you know, tall, dark, black man. It was like, but he's so well-spoken and so talented. Right? Wait a minute. This is wrong. But this is what has to happen. So I would look at your work and say, this woman is out here trying to tell stories about activists and showing people what it looks like to fight for your rights. Because your first character, your first book, this woman fought for her rights as a woman and as a mother. And the Crafts fought for their rights as Black people and the rights of other Black people. I'm like, what's next? Who's your next hidden history activist that you're going to talk about? I mean, my question for you in that sense just is like, do you see yourself thinking that way about these stories, or do you just find them fascinating stories and it's just coincidental that these people are activist revolutionaries in their own right?
I mean, I would love to be an evangelist for the power of activist storytelling. I mean, if that's something that I can achieve, like get people excited about taking action and taking heart and gaining energy from the Crafts example, then I feel like I've done my job. I mean, I guess I didn't want this just to be a small picture of them. And the original plan actually was to end the story once they set foot in England, because then they've technically achieved their goal of no longer being in bondage. But I think it's that larger impulse to show what they did, the choices they made in freedom, and how they continue to speak all over the world that drove me through that next section. And the story would not have been complete without it.
Shifting gears just a little bit, but kind of along the same lines, I'm wondering if you, when you chose the topics of your story subjects, one is a white American woman and the other is a Black American couple. I'm wondering if you as an Asian American woman have ever been challenged about your right to tell these stories, either a white woman's story or a Black couple's story. Has your ethnic identity ever come into question, so to speak, in terms of your right to tell these different stories? Or maybe it's different as a historian. I don't know.
Well, I think that's actually a very big difference. We're writing fiction versus nonfiction. So with the writing that I'm doing, I mean, it's grounded in scholarship. You can see like a gazillion footnotes and sources, and I have not dared to imagine or enter imaginatively into that world. This is history. So that may be one of the reasons why, but I actually find that I get the question, have you been challenged, more than I have actually gotten questions about. You know what I mean? It's kind of like on a meta level. Yeah, the question about the question rather than the question itself.
Well, it's interesting because I wouldn't really think about again, historians. I mean, I look at biographies, like, you know, I have this amazing biography of Frederick Douglass, the author's wife. You know, there's different biographies of different people. And I don't look at biography authors like, well, are they the same ethnic background as the person they're writing about? But there's a new book out called The Sisterhood that tells the story of this Black writers group that Toni Morrison, Alice Walker, Audre Lorde, they were all in this writers group together. And the woman who wrote the book happens to be Caucasian. She's white. And there was a debate, kind of, you know, an online debate, so to speak. I don't know if it got legs beyond like certain groups of women, but some women were like, they weren't, I guess there was a little bit of anger that it was a white woman telling this very Black woman's story. But then the pushback was, this woman is a scholar. Her specialty was in African-American literature. She wrote the book very well, et cetera, et cetera. And she's not claiming anything. She's bringing a story to light. Yeah, so it just made me think, do people have to ask permission or do you have to share the background of a historical figure in order to write about that historical figure? That would be quite limiting. But I just wanted to know if that had happened to you. So you're saying it really has not been a question, except for people like me asking you if it's been a question.
I guess, yeah, the short answer is yes. I get the question about the question more than the question. But I think it's a really valid question because I think there are definite challenges and limitations when you're writing outside the culture. And there are all sorts of things you have to be, I felt like I had to be especially mindful of what I don't know, looking for a wide range of readers to help me where there are things that I can't see, like to help me identify my blind spots, which are going to be there no matter how hard I try. But the process of telling a story and telling history is a collaborative process, in that you're talking both to people who have written before. Actually, you're also talking to people who will write after you. You're talking to editors, you're talking to readers, you're engaging, at least for me. Writing has not been a solitary experience. And that was important to do that, again, to be maximally respectful to the crafts and to really try to be able to get inside their story the best that I could. And I've actually, you know, when I started out on this whole path, I was hearing in my mind, too, some conversations I've heard among Asian Americans when there have been stories told from people outside our culture. And I remember hearing some people who are quite angry about, let's say, a white male or apparently white male writer doing fiction that was set in Korea. Like, how do they know? Or like, what right do they have? And so I was aware that there is that standard, that bar for suspending disbelief is going to be much, much higher, that every wrong note is going to be heard. So if you're going to play it, then you have to be, you have to use a tuner, like every possible tuner that you can. But there's a point at which, as a scholar, you find that the story needs to be told because there's so many things that might be coming through the archives. Like, that's what happened for me. Because again, I would have loved to read the story. But once I started looking in the archives, there's just so many different things that came up. And it felt like important to share this information. But again, going back to the idea of possession that we kind of started with, this is a story that belongs to the craft descendants, that belongs to a larger public. It's not something that I'm trying to claim in every way. Anyway, I'm actually thinking about the book as a point of a starting point and a new point of departure.
You know, it's kind of, I don't know, maybe a little bit of pressure that this craft descendants, were they part of the writing process? Did they know you were writing the book? What was that like in terms of their involvement in the actual production of the book?
I have to say that encountering the craft descendants has been one of the best parts of my journey with this book. And I was not able to reach them when I was doing the heavy duty writing. It was in a later phase when actually I had completed all the research. But they've been so generous and receptive. And that's something that they were really even before long, like many years ago. There are descendants who started telling and sharing the craft story publicly, you know, made a small documentary about them. I have their pictures up on my wall, actually. Miss Peggy Totter Damond Priestley's mother, Ellen Damond. She's a beautiful, as Miss Peggy calls her, as the griot of the family. And so there was a lot of that history that she was bringing to light. Other craft descendants have decided to share this incredibly rich archive of materials that they have in the family. with the world of scholarship by making them publicly accessible and actually digitally accessible through the Avery Research Center in Charleston. So they've been incredibly generous, both with me and with the world, with their just unparalleled resources.
That's incredible. What a gift. I mean, to be able to write about these historical figures and then actually meet their descendants. I mean, it seems like any historian's greatest icing on the cake, if you will. That's just so exciting.
Oh, dream come true. Yeah. Actually, I want to, especially since I know you're on Instagram, since that's how we connected, they actually have started, they're starting a foundation. So the William and Ellen Craft Foundation, and they have an Instagram account, and they've been posting daily histories, not just related to their own family, but Black history for Black History Month. And I am learning so much. They have these amazing pictures and pieces of history that they're sharing and making publicly available digitally.
Well, I will definitely put a link to that in the show notes as well. I love that. So the last question on this topic, just in general, do you feel in any way like a role model for other Asian American writers? Like, do you see yourself as, I guess I'm asking this because I come from a long line of journalism and covering ethnic communities, and a lot of, there just aren't as many public-facing Asian American, let's say, popular writers in this historical space. Not that there aren't, but you definitely have a high profile in this space. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about, role model might be a strong word, but it's more like, you know, like, what, if anything, do you have in terms of advice for emerging Asian American writers who are looking for, like, you know, I don't know, maybe permission to tell wide-ranging stories, maybe advice of like how to like get their stories out into the world. What would you say?
Wow, that's actually a lovely idea, the idea of being a role model. And you're right, when I was growing up, you know, there were some really big writers like Maxine Hunt Kingston, who I actually hadn't heard of. Like, I remember the first Asian American author I read in high school was Amy Tan's Joy Luck Club. And I remember reading about it in 17 magazine and being so excited. I just couldn't even imagine the idea of a novel about Asian Americans. It didn't matter. It wasn't Korean American. It was like, you know, Chinese American, but it felt close enough. And, you know, I grew up at a time when we would run to the TV when there was an Asian face on it. And the bookshelf was really the same thing. I wasn't reading about other people like me. So to be part of a generation that is actually doing a lot more publishing, it feels really good. So if I can be a role model to others in the BIPOC community, then yeah, that would be an honor. In terms of specific advice, I guess don't be afraid to follow what it is that you're truly passionate about, no matter what the topic is. Like, if it calls you, find a way into it and a way to do it respectfully, but with passion. I also found myself at various points in my life being questioned, you know, not even with this book, but like for what I wanted to study or what I wanted to read. When I was an undergrad, there was a great books course in my freshman year that I was interested in doing. It was like, what is a great book? Like, what makes a book great? Why are these books chosen for this? And are they really great? And maybe I'll have my own ideas of what a great book is. But actually, that very year, the dean of the college was like, everyone should be doing this Western Civ program and everyone should read the great books. And people were really offended by that. And then those of us, there were like a handful of us BIPOC students in this program to start off with. But I found myself challenged, like, why are you reading this? Why are you reading these dead white men? And, you know, being called like a Twinkie or a banana, you know, that kind of thing. And it had nothing to do with my relationship to my ancestral culture. And it was never mutually exclusive. I've been passionate about my own family culture and history as well. It's just not something I've chosen to write about. I still don't know why I'm obsessed with the Shakers for so long, but
your parents. Blame your parents.
Maybe it's part of my ancestral culture as well. And that,
yes, it is. Like, right? Your parents did that to you. You're like my Korean American Shaker parents, like, you know, Shaker obsessed. They did this to me.
That's right.
I love that. All right. So now we're getting to the quick fun questions. Ileane, when you write, do you have any rituals? Do you light candles? Do you eat Twizzlers? Do you have to sit in a special chair? What are the things that you like to do or must do when you start writing?
I meditate before I start. And I have a great solution for writing footnotes, which I loathe. I get a bowl of jelly beans and I give myself one jelly bean per footnote, per round on the footnote, because most of the footnotes I've gone over like multiple times. So each time I get through a round, I get one jelly bean.
I love that. My last guest was Tia Williams, and she has a bowl of Reese's Pieces on her desk. So far we've got Reese's Pieces and now jelly beans. So listeners, get your bowl of candy. And clearly that is what it takes to be a successful writer.
Okay. Bribery, yes.
Yes, that's what it is. And finally, is there a book that you're working on now that you could give us a sense of? It's okay if you're not. I mean, I think after writing Master Slave Husband Wife, I might take a 5-year break, but is there something you're working on that you want to tell us about?
You know, not yet. I am actually engaged in a lot of oral storytelling now as I talk about the crafts, and I hope that that will also show up in my work, because definitely when I was writing Master Slave Husband Wife, I thought about it as something seen, as something heard, as much as something on the page. I wanted it to move in that way, and now that I'm on the road, I can use all kinds of images, which are just amazing. I mean, again, especially thanks to the generosity of the crafts and sharing these beautiful archival photos. So I'm engaged in oral storytelling for now. I hope something will hit me in terms of more research, but I think I'm still with the crafts for a little while longer.
And this just actually occurred to me again, because of the way you tell your stories. Have you ever considered fiction? Has that occurred to you? Because you're like, these stories almost read like novels. Has that ever pinged your imagination to do fiction?
It has, but it's also scary. It's possible I could turn there. I mean, that's actually all I read. I will devour giant historical tomes out of necessity, but for my pleasure, I'm purely a fiction reader. So that would be amazing, but also terrifying.
Okay, I'm going to just say something, and I don't want to freak you out, but people who come on my podcast end up having like really amazing success based on something I predict.
All right.
Okay, so like Tembi Lack was on my podcast, and I was like, your memoir From Scratch, it's going to be a movie. And she kind of knew already, but she couldn't say it publicly, but I predicted it on the podcast, and other things have happened. So I'm just saying it right now for everybody listening, I think Ilyan Wu is going to write a novel, and it's going to be a delicious historical fiction something, and we're all going to just be overwhelmed, and it may or may not have shakers in it. I don't know. But there's my prediction.
I love it.
There's my prediction.
I hope that would be amazing.
So we could go on talking, but I am going to let you go. But before I do, can you tell everybody where they can find you on the social interwebs if they want to follow you and your oral history journey and all that other good stuff?
Thank you. Yes, my website is www.ilyanwu.com. And I just joined Instagram last year, so I'm still pretty new to it, but I love it. So find me on Ilyan Wu Author.
And of course, everybody, I will have those links in the show notes for you to find. And Ilyan, thank you again so much for this very enlightening and fun conversation. I know that I am definitely going to read your first book, because I'm so fascinated by this woman who took on the shakers. Thank you so much. And we will be following your career as you continue with spreading the word about the crafts. Thank you.
Thank you. This has been great.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Ilyan. I am still pumped up about it and could have kept talking to her for hours. I really am going to add her first book about the shakers to my TBR list because it sounds fascinating. And speaking of fascinating, here are some fascinating takeaways for you from my conversation with Ilyan Wu. 1. Don't listen to naysayers or critics who want to limit the scope of what you get to write about. Write about the stories that speak to you. But if you are writing about a group of people that is not your own, you must be flawless with your work. 2, writing a big, bold nonfiction book is a collaborative project. Do not think you have to go it alone. 3, if you can be an evangelist for activist storytelling, by all means, do so. 4, if you can't travel, but you need to do historical research on place, Yes, there's Google Maps, but also try looking at 19th century and other historical maps to get more accurate renditions of the world you're trying to recreate. And number five, sometimes when you're stuck with your writing, you need to look to other artistic disciplines to find your way forward. All right, don't forget Ilyan Wu's extraordinary book, Master Slave, Husband, Wife, An Epic Journey from Slavery to Freedom, just came out in paperback in February 2024 and is available everywhere books are sold. We will have links to both of Ilyan's books in the show notes, as well as links to all of her online hangouts. Thank you for listening to this award-winning podcast. I really hope it inspires you to keep writing and keep working on getting your words out into the world, because the world needs more BIPOC stories by BIPOC writers like you. If you're looking for more creative writing inspiration, writing prompts, and useful resources for your literary life, then be sure to check out the Read, Write, and Create website at readwriteandcreate.com. Don't forget, that's R-E-E-D, writeandcreate.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for the Read, Write, and Create monthly newsletter, which is the first place where you'll find out about my latest classes and creative offerings. My latest creative offering, just FYI, is The Sanctuary. The Sanctuary is a private membership community specifically for BIPOC women writers who want to get published and get paid. Inside The Sanctuary, we offer things like writing workshops, co-writing sessions, author visits, beta readers for your work, and opportunities galore to get published and get paid, all for just $37 a month. So if you're a BIPOC woman writer and you've been searching for that supportive community and accountability for your writing projects, visit the Sanctuary link on the Read, Write, and Create website. And you can also sign up for our open house that we're hosting on March 16th to ask your questions and get a taste of life inside the Sanctuary. The Read, Write, and Create podcast is written and produced by me, Lori L. Tharps. Our editor is Brad Linder, and our theme music is by Wattaboy. I'll be back in 2 weeks on Monday. Until then, keep being a storytelling evangelist and keep writing.